It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off today. 3 years ago today, Governor Scott Walker signed Act 10 into law. It was exactly 1 month after he unveiled his budget repair bill and urged quick action. The 16-hour public hearing that convened days after Walker's announcement marked the beginning of a period of intense political contention in Wisconsin. It ultimately led to the recall election of the governor. One of the lawmakers co-chairing Act 10's public hearing back in 2011 was Robin Voss. Now the Assembly Speaker, he was then co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee. As part of our week-long series on Act 10, 3 years in, we're joined by Speaker Voss to discuss the impact the law has had so far in Wisconsin. Representative Voss, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me, Rob.
Well, let's walk back a few years. You were co-chair of Joint Finance when Act 10 was introduced. Days after the legislation, there was a 16-hour public hearing. Protests were starting. What did you make of the testimony you were hearing against the bill of the protests at the time?
Well, we certainly knew that the topic was going to be controversial because any time that you do real, meaningful reform, people who enjoy the status quo are always going to turn out in pretty great numbers. And there's no doubt that over the course of the months that we struggled to get Act 10 to become law, that that was definitely the case. I think that it's pretty obvious now, looking back, that it was the right decision to make. It was sure tough. I'm not going to say that it was easy for anybody, including myself or other state employees who had to begin paying in for their pensions and to pay a little bit toward their health care. But it certainly was the right decision. And I think at the end of the day, it's borne out by all the facts that we now know.
When it was signed into law, finally, after some protest, what did you imagine success looking like? What was a win for Act 10, say, 2-3 years down the road?
Well, I was just happy that we were going to be able to have a budget that was balanced, knowing how tough the fiscal times were. We had just left with Democrats in control, where we walked in the door with a $3.6 billion deficit. Taxes had already gone up by nearly $5 billion over the course of the past several years. And we were just wanting to make sure that the budget was really in balance and that we could do it in a way that didn't result in tax increases for average Wisconsin citizens. So that was the first goal that we accomplished. My second long-term goal was giving more opportunities for local governments to be able to control their own destiny. I had served on our county board and as chair of the Finance and Personnel Committee, and while I think that the people who sat down at the table were good, honest, hardworking state or public employees, they're still had a situation where the deck seemed to be stacked, where the only thing that the taxpayer would have the opportunity to do was to figure out how much more we were going to pay, as opposed to trying to find ways to save and form a partnership. So unfortunately, we had to take more radical moves to be able to say that government should do what's in the best interest of taxpayers and not just protect the status quo.
3 years today since Governor Walker signed the law. Do you have any disappointments about how it was implemented? Any regrets about how it was from the outset?
Well, the only thing that I wish we would have done differently, because those of us who had been in office and ran on a platform of finally fixing Wisconsin's problems were pretty committed to do it. Our caucus had almost half brand new members who ran on that exact platform. I think we could have done a better job of communicating why the need was there, where some of the abuses had occurred, where individuals, as an example, in the prison system would call in sick and then show up for the next shift so they could be paid overtime. I mean, all kinds of instances like that would have probably done a better job of building the public case. But I think Governor Walker has also admitted we didn't focus on the politics. We were more focused on solving the problem. Perhaps if we had taken a little bit more time to explain to the public, we wouldn't have had the same level of frustration and anger. But I guess the best indicator is what's happened as far as the results. And I'm certainly proud of where Wisconsin is with now a $1 billion surplus, more tax cuts for every single family that pays taxes. And we've seen all the predictions about massive layoffs and public employees going bankrupt, those things just haven't proven true. So I guess I'm glad that we succeeded and also happy that many of the fears that were brought up at the time just weren't true.
One concern that was brought up at the time was morale, especially among teachers. Some people have expressed concern that teachers are demoralized since the bill passed. Some retired soon after. And as a consequence, education in the state is suffering. What would you say to that?
Well, some employees did retire, and they did that in their own best financial interest because they had a sweetheart deal and they wanted to lock it in. So I don't fault them for necessarily doing that. But at the same time, I certainly hope that they wouldn't fault us for doing what's in the best long-term interests of local governments, taxpayers, and kids. Because we've seen all across the state, even though we were told that there would be dire consequences for children, it just hasn't worked out that way. We see that school districts across the state have new flexibilities. They're now able to shop for the best health insurance, not just say we only have one choice for everybody at a higher price than it should be. They're able to give teachers merit pay if they decide that's best for their district. They're able to change how they operate, all in a way that instead of focusing on the adults, we're finally focusing our effort on the kids and the results that they need. So I certainly am proud of what we've done, and I think that over the long haul, as we look back years from now, we're going to be thankful that we had the courage to make tough choices because the kids were the one who came first.
But are we, with the changes that have happened, still able to compete to get the best teachers in the country to our schools here in Wisconsin?
Oh, there's no doubt about it, Rob. We know that even today, when you have an open position for a school district, hundreds of people still apply, and that's because we're still a great place to work. Working in a school district where you get a fully funded pension, you have to pay half, which is about what's normal in the private sector, and you get some of the very best health insurance anywhere in the country, those are two great draws that were only changed in a very minor way. We have very competitive wages, and now you have a workplace that rewards excellence. And I think that anybody who wants to go into public education or any private sector job wants to know that they're recognized, and I think we all know great teachers are one of the most important things we can have to make our state prosper. But we also want to make sure that the very best are rewarded, and it's not based on how long you've been there, but instead on how good you do with kids.
Now, Governor Walker, when he ran mainly on creating jobs in his original election, I should say. Act 10 was not explicitly part of his campaign, especially the collective bargaining changes, and it was not directly a job-creating bill. Was it right to spend so much political capital and time on this legislation that wasn't directly a job creator?
Yeah, it was not directly related to jobs. You're exactly right. But it was directly related to reforming Wisconsin so that we could invest in the long run in the things that will create a prosperous Wisconsin. That's why we've been able to cut taxes three different times in the past 2 years alone. We had a large income tax cut for everybody in Wisconsin that pays income taxes. We now have seen property taxes that are going to go down because of the surplus by $85 per $1,000 of value. So I think we've been able to showcase that, yes, it was a tough choice in the beginning, but it certainly set the stage for Wisconsin's future prosperity that's being shared with everybody.
Do you see Wisconsin taking any big next steps, something like a right-to-work law, which we've seen in other states?
I certainly think we want to take one step at a time. That is probably not something on the foreseeable horizon. At the same time, I have always supported the idea of giving workers the freedom to choose to join a union or not, but I don't think that in Wisconsin at a time when we are focused on trying to grow our economy, that that would be something that would do that at this point.
I want to take you back 3 years and 2 months ago. You and your Democratic Assembly colleague Mark Pocan issued a bipartisan call for civility in Wisconsin politics, now Congressman Mark Pocan. Then Act 10 happened, the protests happened, a lot of division, acrimony in and outside the Capitol. Are we anywhere near bringing back any modicum of bipartisan civility in the years since then?
Oh, we certainly are. I think that we had a tough 2 years. I'm not going to say that we didn't. Mark and I just had dinner in Washington, D.C. He is still one of the finest guys that I know. We disagree on many public policy issues, but I think he's a man of his word, and he's somebody who certainly is working out for what he believes is best for Wisconsin, and I respect him for that. I've tried to do things as much as possible to reach out to Democrats and Republicans. We have a regular lunch where Democrats and Republicans get together for the first time and just get to know each other as people, because that's the way you form a relationship, and that's how you build the possibility of working together. 95% of the bills that have become law had bipartisan support. So the vast majority of things that we do are areas where we've already found common ground. It's just the ones that get reported by the media are most often the difficult issues where we can't reach consensus, and we just have to make a decision on the right or the left, but we have to make a choice one way or the other.
Big election year. What do you see as some of the big issues, contentious or otherwise, leading up to November?
You know, it's still going to be about where we're going in Wisconsin. I am so proud of the way that our state is heading. We have almost 100,000 jobs that have been created, consistently good, compared to during the last few years of Governor Doyle's term, where we lost over 100,000 jobs. We now see a brand new survey that came out that's showing Wisconsin is one of the best places in the country, where they are predicting future job growth, according to Manpower, who's a leading indicator. And at the same time, we see our tax collections are doing better because people are expanding and they're earning more. So I think those are all going to be topics discussed in the fall, but making sure we have great schools, which we've been working on, making sure that we have a healthcare system that's controlled by people right here in Wisconsin and not in Washington, and then ultimately investing in our priorities of worker training and more money for taxpayers. I think the election's going to focus on those things, and I'm sure glad we're on the right side of those topics.
Speaker Voss, thanks for taking time out of a busy schedule in the Assembly.
Thanks, Rob. Have a great day.
That was Wisconsin State Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. He joined us as part of our Act 10 3 Years In series. Today marks the third anniversary of Governor Walker signing Act 10 into law. Throughout the week, we're looking at that issue, the effect of Act 10 on Wisconsin. Tomorrow, we'll speak with Senator John Erpenbach. He was a Democrat, still is a Democrat, and he was one of the Senate 14 who fled the state to avoid quorum to try to delay passage of that act. The state Senate is winding down for the legislative session, but today it took up a series of elections-related bills, including one that would limit early voting hours in the state. The Senate bill advanced through a committee last week on a party-line vote. Last year, the Assembly passed similar legislation. Joining us now to talk more about early voting in Wisconsin and what this bill would do is Tim Dale, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UW-La Crosse. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So under this bill, how would early voting laws change in Wisconsin?
Well, the bill that's being considered would limit early voting hours to weekdays only, looking at the hours of 8 to 7 being the limit. And this would have the effect of eliminating weekend voting hours for early voting.
And a lot of people might be surprised that you can currently vote on weekends. What are the current laws in Wisconsin regarding that and whether local local election units can do that?
Yeah, well, clerks have a pretty wide range of discretion right now. And the way that it works is that in certain areas, clerks can stay open to maximize the ability of people to vote. And so what ends up happening is that in urban areas where there's a little bit more budgeted for clerk's offices, stay open, offices can be open for early voting on weekends and later into evenings. And so a lot of voter registration drives and voter drives happen during these times when people aren't working or when the drives are able to happen.
Republicans are taking the lead on this bill. What's their case? Why do they say we need this change?
Well, the argument follows kind of along the lines that I was just describing. In the current situation, cities and areas that have a higher population tend to be open longer hours. The Republicans' argument is that this places an unfair burden on more rural areas where they don't have the budgets to keep registration offices open, and therefore you do see longer hours in urban areas. The Republicans' argument is that this situation should be equitable, and so setting a guideline that has all state offices open for set periods during weekdays would create a kind of conformity across all of these clerk's offices that we don't have currently.
So they're saying, if I'm a rural voter, I'm looking at Madison and Milwaukee in particular, saying, hey, why are they getting more voting chances than I do?
Right, exactly.
And then Democrats have opposed this bill. We've seen a rally in Milwaukee, including Mayor Barrett. I think there's been opposition here in Madison. What's been the case against passing these changes?
Well, the argument that you're seeing from Barrett and other Democrats is that in higher population areas, these areas ought to be allowed to do things differently. In higher population areas, you have different demographics. You have people who perhaps work different hours. You have a higher population, which may mean that the pressures put on voter turnout are different. So basically the argument is that different areas should be allowed to have offices open. And their further argument is that these kind of the efforts for voter early voting should be aimed at higher voter turnout. And so the argument also extending to apply to rural areas would be that perhaps rural areas should be funded to have their offices open longer. So essentially, Democrats want the extended office hours, and they are willing to have any number of compromises that would allow that to happen.
And this is one of those cases where, by coincidence, the principles invoked by both parties line up with where their voters are. Democrats tend to get better turnouts in cities and the higher population counties in the state, Republicans in some of the smaller areas. I know we can't look inside the heads of the politicians on both sides, but do you think that's a factor?
Well, I think that the political questions are certainly a factor. And I think when we're having our most cynical points of analysis, we would say exactly what you said, which is that Republican voters tend to be in rural areas, which is where the Republicans are speaking to places being disadvantaged. Democratic voters tend to come from the urban areas. There's also the question of overall turnout. So in elections where there are lower turnouts of voters, Republicans tend to do better. And in elections where there are, is a higher voter turnout, Democrats tend to do better. And so there's also the tendency for Republicans to be more comfortable with things that make it more difficult to vote, with the argument, the principled argument, that voting should be fair, that voting should be equal across the board. But Republicans are more comfortable if it's harder to register to vote in general, and that's just a question of turnout.
Has there been a trend nationally lately toward more and more early voting?
There has, and there have been efforts all over the country to make it easier and easier to vote. There have been some states to even go more toward vote-by-mail processes, and I think that the number of votes that we see being cast in absentee format is higher and higher. One of the reasons for this is strategic. Both of the parties have concentrated a great deal of effort and energy on getting out the vote early. And so if people can vote absentee early, then the parties realize that this is a good way to count on votes. Kind of as the election draws nearer, you know how much work you have to do and where that work needs to be done. I think state laws have accommodated this, but as much as it has been accommodated, I think we've also seen an effort recently, the way that we're seeing in Wisconsin, to push back against that with the argument that but what you're seeing from the Republicans in Wisconsin right now, that if these efforts are inequitable, or if we see certain areas of the state being benefited by some of these early voting trends, then state legislatures have started to respond.
That's interesting. So with early voting, with more absentee voting, if I'm a campaign manager or a party official, I don't have to put all my eggs in my election day activity. I can start working on drives to get people to the polls anytime in that couple of weeks leading up.
Right. And people who work within campaigns kind of have a banking mentality, that they see those votes as banked votes. Mm-hmm. And so you can get a sense of how your candidate is doing and where your efforts have to go as those votes are banked for your candidate. There are also a lot of uncertainties on election day. So as we all know, and when it rains or snows, voter turnout goes down. There also are long lines. We know we've seen stories, and we've experienced it ourselves. We show to the poll at a certain time, a machine goes down or two machines go down, and now you're limited and people are standing for an hour or two. People who work in campaigns know that they can't always count on election day to go as smoothly as possible. And so this early voting really allows a way around that for campaigns to know who they're counting on, and that something isn't going to go wrong, at least for early voting.
Let's go to a caller at 800-642-1234. We have Diane with us in Mercer. Diane, hi.
Hi. The speaker said that, you know, they wanted to make things equitable. And being in a rural, I've lived in Milwaukee and I live up here now. There are all kinds of things that we don't get that the bigger cities get. Like I said, if I want to go and renew my license, you know, that's open once a month. If I want to go to the post office, we have very limited hours up here. How come they're not working on making all these other things equitable?
But do you think voting is particularly important? You'd like to see that be equitable with a place like Milwaukee or Madison?
Voting up here is very easy. There aren't any lines ever. There's plenty of people. It would be nice if there was more hours, but things always seem to go smooth.
All right, Diane, thanks a lot for sharing your perspective from up there in Mercer. So, Tim, at least one voter up there thinks voting is the least of their worries for inequities with the rest of the state in northern Wisconsin.
Right, and I think that the caller kind of reflects one of the issues in contention here with this legislation, which is there's a question of fairness, that is, an office being open a certain number of hours versus another office being open a different number of hours. And that is an issue of equity just in the number of hours. But the issue of equity that the Democrats are talking about are the issue of population pressure. So where we see giant lines at the polling places on election day, those typically aren't in rural areas. Those are in urban and suburban areas. And so there is an unequal pressure on polling places oftentimes in urban areas. And I think so that the question at the heart of this is, really, what counts as inequitable? Is it a question of hours being open and availability, or is it a question of population pressures? I think depending on where you stand on that issue is really where you come down, either with the Republicans or the Democrats.
Well, that's an interesting contrast. We're talking with Tim Dale. He's professor of political science at UW-La Crosse, talking about a proposed bill. It's in the legislature. We're actually watching for a vote in it in the state Senate today. It would limit early voting in Wisconsin, as Professor Dale has told us. It would take away weekends as an early voting option. Currently, that happens a lot in the bigger cities, Madison and Milwaukee in particular. We want to hear from you on this. Do you vote early? Have you taken advantage of this? How do you feel about this proposal? Do you think it's fair that some communities are able to vote early on weekends, some aren't? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And what's voting like where you live in Wisconsin? By the way, you can also post on our Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with Tim Dale, assistant professor of political science at UW-La Crosse, about a proposed bill that would limit early voting in Wisconsin. Right now, county clerks, local governments can have weekend voting, among other things. This new law would restrict that. Sean Johnson of WPR News reports that a vote on that in the Senate probably won't happen this afternoon, maybe one of those late night sessions. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How flexible should communities be when it comes to setting up their early voting times? 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Back to your calls now. We've got Marshall on the line in Wausau. Marshall, hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm just wondering, instead of worrying about the times that the polls are open and such, why not just making voting a state or national holiday so that people don't have to worry about making this fit in with work or such like that?
Marshall, thanks for the call. And Tim, when we talk about voting in Wisconsin, we often hear this suggestion, a random, more or less, Tuesday isn't the greatest day to have an election.
Right. Well, the caller suggests one of the proposals that's out there, which is to make Election Day a national holiday. Of course, even on holidays, some people have to work. Mm-hmm. Another suggestion is to make Election Day a Saturday, so to move it from a Tuesday to a Saturday. But I think one of the ways around that, at least the way that the states have done it, is this idea of early voting and absentee voting. And the early voting that we're talking about is sometimes not even absentee. Voters don't necessarily have to prove that they aren't going to be available on Election Day. They just get to vote and can vote starting weeks before the election. So having a period of voting that extends far beyond a single day is something that advocates typically argue is even better than a national holiday. Like I said, even if something is a holiday, you would have some people who still have to work. So the extended voting hours, even if it's under the limits that the Republicans are proposing, it tends to be a compromise that many people favor.
You know, with early voting, how much does that affect how pollsters do their work? Because now, I mean, if there was just one day, you're looking at that poll from the day before, if people can start voting 2 or 3 weeks out, how much do you have to pay attention to the polling those days instead?
Yeah, well, it definitely has affected it. So the people who run polls on Election Day, some of the polls we see that are exit polls, those polls are taken directly from people who are leaving the polling place. In a way, actually, early voting makes numbers that we see from polls taken ahead of time, that is with sample sizes, 1,000, 1,500 likely voters, it actually makes those polls much more accurate because pollsters are including in their questions, have you voted already? And that obviously makes the predicting how a person is going to vote puts it at 100%. So those numbers actually, when pollsters, and they are accounting for early voting, that makes those numbers much more solid in terms of predicting outcomes of elections.
Marshall, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Kathy in Madison. Hi there, Kathy.
Hello. My opinion is that extra hours should be allowed. I voted for 15 years in a small town. I never stood in line. In fact, I rarely saw anyone else voting while I was there. There was no traffic as I drove home. And in Madison, I've lived now for 25 years, and I also voted in here in my last year of college, or one of my years of college. And I stood in long lines. I've had my polling place changed. I have used voting ahead of time, too, because of the predicted lines. And so I think when you're, it's ridiculous to say it's unfair when you're in a metropolitan area where people have to deal with traffic and parking, you know.
Kathy,
that's my feeling.
Kathy, thanks for the call. And that's one side of that equity argument you mentioned earlier, Tim, that, you know, some people say, oh, it's not fair that some cities get more hours, weekend opportunities. She's the counterpoint to that.
It is. And I think that the argument that the Republicans are making is that if we set up the voting at certain set times, that I think that the proposal is 8 a.m. to 7 p.m., that already that having extended voting hours during that time is generous enough to get people to a poll. And I think that's where the caller raises what Democrats are arguing, which is that generous enough is not enough. And so if you ask people who mobilize voters in urban areas, they're making the argument that it is not enough. So that is definitely the terms of this debate.
Thanks for the call, Kathy. We've got Chris on the line now in Appleton. Chris, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. What percentage of eligible voters vote in urban counties, and what percentage of eligible voters vote in rural counties? Thank you.
Chris, thanks for the call. Tim, I don't know if you have those numbers at your fingertips, but do you have a broad stroke there?
Yeah, so voters in rural areas tend to turn out to vote in higher percentages, but of course any discussion of voter turnout would be relative to particular elections. And what we see in the state of Wisconsin is something typical that we see across the country, which is in presidential elections, voter turnout is much higher. And in presidential elections, voters in urban areas tend to vote at higher rates. In midterm elections and off elections, where we're voting for local or state races, though that turnout tends to be lower overall. But the lower voter turnout tends to come from urban areas, so the turnout doesn't dip as much in rural areas. So I'm not sure if that answers the caller's question, but we do see turnout to be higher in rural areas overall as a matter of average, but that tends to equalize in presidential elections.
We'll go now to Jim in Milton. Jim, hi.
Hello, thank you. It's really hard to listen to this conversation because it seems to me that there's just a charade taking place that the Republican position has some sort of legitimacy when we know that there's a national strategy on the part of Republican conservative organizations to have the states limit voting in a whole variety of ways. People are on the record, Republican legislators and party members in Florida, Virginia, other places, as well as the results of their think tanks are on the record that they want to limit voting by people in order to further the goals of the Republican Party. And what really makes it hard is that we're dealing with a legislature involved in this, in a gerrymandered state where many more Democrats vote than, and yet the Republicans hold all those seats.
Jim.
And so it's really a challenge for democracy, small d, to see all this taking place.
Jim, thanks for the call. Tim, Jim says this is part of an intentional, concentrated Republican campaign to suppress voting.
Yeah, we talked about that several minutes ago, that kind of the cynical assessment of both sides is that their strategies around issues of voting are all about what benefits them electorally. So the Republicans would say the same thing about Democrats wanting to have extended hours in urban areas, that, of course, Democrats want that because they're concentrating their efforts on turnout in urban areas. I think that the bigger issue, and I think that the caller raises this question, is kind of what counts as good voting practices in a democracy. And I think this links to other voter ID debates that we have going on currently in Wisconsin. The courts are going to weigh in, and it looks like there may be a special session of the legislature. And I think that the question about voting is whether or not it's good to have a rigorous voting process that makes it difficult or requires effort to vote. There's another position on voting that says that voting doesn't have to be easy, that it should be accountable. That is, so the preference would be for accountability in voting rather than ease in voting. I think the other side says that, and this is, I think, what the caller was expressing, that in order for democracy to work, voting has to be available to all, and it has to be something that is easy. When that happens, though, accountability tends to go down. And that's something that that side of the argument would be more comfortable with. So I think there is a deep, more principled argument that's happening here. Even as the caller points out, there are some pretty clear electoral advantages that come from each side of the argument.
Time for one more caller. We've got Jennifer with us in Muskego. Jennifer, hi.
Hi, yes, I was listening, and I just guess I'm concerned that the politicians are spending so much time focusing on who can vote when and how long. If it's not fixed, don't break it. Could we fix the construction issues in Wisconsin so I don't take so long to get to work and back home again?
All right. Thanks for the call, Jennifer. So do voters care about making this tweak to when we can vote, do you think, Tim?
I'm not sure that, everyone cares about these voting issues, although the people who are affected the most by it certainly would care about it. I think that the reason that legislators spend so much time talking about voting, and that is even relative to things that, as your caller suggests, might be more important kind of for the day-to-day operation of state government, is that it really comes to the heart of our government and what we think as our primary accountability mechanism for government is, which is the vote. And so I think while the caller is right, there are a lot of other things that are of concern. The vote is kind of that sacred center of American democracy. And so discussions around that go beyond just what do we want to work for government today. It's how do we want government to work for us into the future.
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Tim Dale, assistant professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. We talked with him about a bill that would limit early voting hours here in Wisconsin. The weather is finally starting to get a little warmer, which means one thing for those who live near a sugar bush, it's time to start thinking about tapping those sugar maples. In this week's Teach Me What You Know, how to make maple syrup. Every week at this time, we learn a new skill. We've learned how to prepare our taxes or how to write a book. This week, we have Tony Schultz with us. He's the farmer at Stony Acres Farm in Athens, Wisconsin, and that includes Stony Acres Sugar Bush. He's a third-generation maple syrup maker. Tony, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me on. I'm a big fan.
Oh, thank you. Well, what's the process of making maple syrup like? Is it difficult, time-consuming?
I would definitely say, well, it depends on how much you'd like to make. I think you can do it as a hobby, as a family. You can go behind your house if you have maple trees in your yard. So you have to be able to identify a maple tree. And then
good first step.
Uh-huh. And there are different types of maple trees based on what the bark looks like, but typically we look for a hard maple, and we tap the maple tree with an electric handheld drill. I think it's something that a lot of people would have access to, and put a tap in it, which you can pick up at most hardware stores, sell them. Tap it, gather the sap with a pail as it runs, and then bring it to your house and boil it down over as simple as a stove and watch it to make sure it boils down to the right level, which is about 66% sugar. You bring that sap in, it's about 1 to 3 or maybe even 4% sugar. And so you're just bringing it in and boiling it down into maple syrup. That's as simple as it could get.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to produce it on a commercial scale, you can become as complicated as having vacuum lines to all your trees, and then bringing it to a centralized sugar bush location where you'd boil it all down. You could use a reverse osmosis machine, which is essentially a high-tech filter. It would take it down to about 40% maple syrup, and then you'd finish it off on a high-tech evaporator.
Well, let's break it down a little more. First of all, say we've ID'd that maple tree. Actually, let's start there. For the tree impaired among us, how do we know the maple from the non-maple?
Well, the easiest way for me to tell is that I tapped it the year before. But if you can't tell, you would have to get a book, use a book to identify how the bark looks relative to other trees, and then you sort of begin to get your maple eye as you're going from tree to tree in the woods. And I identify it with a certain type of bark. And if it helps, you can look for, you can dig into the snow and look at the base of the tree for the leaves at the bottom of it. And everybody has an idea about what a maple tree or what a maple leaf looks like.
Mm-hmm. And now if we've just got one good-sized maple tree in the backyard, are we going to get enough maple syrup to serve a breakfast?
I would say, yeah, you could could get enough to serve a breakfast. It would depend on the season, but almost every season you would definitely get enough to serve a breakfast. If you had a good-sized maple tree, say 2 feet in diameter, and you tap that maple tree and we're boiling that down. Yes.
And now the big question, as I understand it, is when. When is the right time to tap a maple tree?
In our climate, I'm in north central Wisconsin near Wausau. We typically go to tap about mid-March or a few days before. But that season has been shifting a little bit earlier in the past couple years as we've had dramatic early March warm-ups. I think people are even start to tap in late February. And if you have vacuum lines, you would tap definitely in mid to late February. So I've heard some people doing that.
How about this year? It's been a rough winter.
Well, this year, we've had such an intense winter with not only the cold, but in my neck of the woods, the dramatic snowfall. It has been the snowiest winter on record. And when my dad said we were going out to tap trees, he said, this is going to separate the sap men from the sap boys. I walked into the woods the other day. I took a step into the snowbank, and it was a higher area where it drifted a little bit. And I'm 6'6", and I was up to my waist.
Wow.
I couldn't take another step. So I had to roll out of the snowbank to get out. So we've been holding off, but these last 2 days have been wonderful, and now we're really getting the itch. And I think we're going to go out and do our first tapping this afternoon.
Now, you mentioned this afternoon already. Great. Well, you mentioned, you know, just doing it on your own. You can do it in a bucket in an operation like yours. You've got lines. How much line are we talking about? How much hose is spread out amongst your maples?
Well, we have about, on any given year, we tap between 2,000 and 2,500 taps. And we have about half of them online. So I'd have to make an estimate of how much hose we have in between each tree. But about half of our trees are online, and that stays up every year.
And you mentioned boiling it down. About how much sap does it take to get, say, a gallon of maple syrup?
Typically, and it depends on the sugar content of the sap, and that can vary by the time of the day, the time of the season, the type of tree it's coming out, the specific geographic location or microclimate of where the tree is. But typically, it is 40 gallons of sap to 1 gallon of maple syrup.
Now, I like my maple syrup, but I wouldn't consider myself a connoisseur. If you put 5 different varieties in front of me, I might not tell one from the other. What kind of things affect the taste of the syrup, and how much variety is there?
Well, maple syrup is graded, and that has to go from lightness to darkness. And a lighter maple syrup will be called grade A, and that's, you'll see a lot of that in most grocery stores will carry that. Grade A is a lighter maple syrup, and it's given that because it seems like it's more pure, quote-unquote. However, more people, driven by sort of the foodie movement, have been selecting grade B maple syrup, which is darker because people think it has a more of a maple flavor. It's darker, it has more mineral content, and it's gathered more compounds from just cooking your equipment throughout the course of the season. And so foodies have been selecting grade B maple syrup for the past 5 years or so.
Well, now, Tony, what do you use? What do you put on your pancakes? B or A?
I do everything, grade B, grade A, but a lot of grade B. I definitely do think there's a maple flavor to that. You can be fooled by sort of the lightness and then think purity. I do think there is sort of a beauty to that when you hold it in the sun and you see this light amber color and you can see the sugar lines running down. But grade B maple syrup definitely has that maple flavor, and it can provide more for the palate.
We've got a caller on the line with a question. We've got Lyman with us in Janesville. Lyman, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I've been dabbling a little bit with maple syrup for probably the last 2-3 years in my own yard, and I only have a couple of trees. But as we took the maple sap down, we found kind of a white precipitate, and I've been told that's nitrates or nitrites. And I wondered if your guest might be able to explain to me a little bit more about that and whether or not there's kind of a correlation to nitrates or nitrites in the groundwater and if that's where that comes from.
Huh.
That's take a my mystery. Hands off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Lyman. Tony, what do you think?
Well, I'm not sure if he is referring to the froth when it's boiled and the sort of the bubbling up of the sort of white froth on top, or
he dropped off the line. Okay. Assuming it's not the froth, that sounds like it's normal, but something that's in there when he's tapping it.
I'm unsure about that being in the groundwater or not. It's not something I've come into contact with.
Okay, Lyman, if that's but if it's in when he's boiling it, white froth is normal, is that right?
Yeah, most maple syrup will have this frothy effect on top, and people will put some saffron oil is one organic way to deal with it, or butter to bring that that foam down. Other commercial tappers use a defoaming agent.
As a maple syrup producer, you are at the whim of the weather. We've had some really bad years in Wisconsin that really hurt the harvest, didn't we?
Absolutely. My family's been doing this for 3 generations, 80 years. And I've been telling people the last 4 years, we have had the 2 best seasons of those 80 years and the 2 worst seasons back to back to back to back. Last year was our best season of all time. We made 735 gallons. And the year before, we made the same investment. We tapped the same amount of trees. We had this dramatic warm-up in early March, and the season was over. We had only 90 gallons of maple syrup.
Wow. That's it. Are you just biting your nails every time around this year?
I am excited to get on with maple syrup season. And there is a little bit of nervousness, but I think more of the intimidation this year has to come with the deep snow level.
Oh, yeah.
So there is a risk involved, but we've always tapped, and we're definitely excited to go through with it. I think there is a little bit more nervousness with the recent volatility, but that's farming, I guess.
And Tony, I put the syrup on pancakes, crepes, maybe butternut squash from time to time. Anywhere else I should be using maple syrup?
Well, definitely, yes. Pancakes. I make pancakes 300 days a year. That's my go-to. But oatmeal, breakfast cereal, maple granola. If you're using a lot of glazes, maple is a great way to, if you can reduce that for a glaze or add it to a glaze. A lot of my pork products, I like adding sort of a maple to all of my pork sausage, and we raise pigs on our farm as well. I get this back from the butcher, and I don't have them seasoned at all because I want to work in my ratio of maple syrup to pork when I'm making pork sausage.
Getting hungry. Tony, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Tony Schultz, farmer at Stony Acres Farm in Athens, Wisconsin. That includes Stony Acres Sugar Bush. By the way, a week from Sunday on March 23rd, Stephanie Elkins will play maple syrup music in her Simply Folk programming from 5 to 8. That's Sunday the 23rd, 5 to 8 on WPR.